Welcome to Between the Lines. Listening to literature online. This is show number 174. How is it that you not see the beauty in each being? Part 1. This book may be very surprising to some. If you've read or know at least a little history, it's not surprising but stunning nonetheless. Hitler's American Model, the United States and the Making of Nazi Race Law, by James Q. Whitman, who is the Ford Foundation Professor of Comparative and Foreign Law at Yale Law School. His books include Harsh Justice, The Origins of Reasonable Doubt, and The Verdict of Battle. He lives in New York City. That's his little bio from the book published, ironically, for the Yale professor by Princeton University Press. This is your host, Monk. Thank you for listening. Fascinating book, Hitler's American Model, The United States and the Making of Nazi Race Law, by James Q. Whitman. I'm going to start with this show on some personal notes. This has been kind of a field of study. In the 1990s, I started working on an epic poem and started sort of downloaded little notes about the U.S. and Nazis and stuff, and it seemed sort of really out there at the time, but yet over the years I developed a sense of it wasn't that far-fetched, a certain level of the U.S. behavior around the world for years I have felt is
Well, first of all, I go way back in history to the what's called the Holocaust of the native people. And then, more currently, consider reported 1 million Iraqis loss of lives from, you know, the invasion of Iraq. Now, to my understanding, it's not by most people, or a lot of people anyway, it's not equated as Nazi or Holocaust, because it's under this sort of umbrella, no offense to umbrellas, of fighting terrorism, which is bullshit, and because it's on foreign soil, so there's like a kind of blindness by the people, which in a way fits my semi-humorous, semi-truthful, or truthful definition, you know, part humor, part truthful definition of Nazism. I like to call it Nazi, N-O-T-S-E-E, because the Nazis and that type of psychology does not see the beauty of the world, does not see, more specifically, that people, the equality of people. They, part of the psychology he explains in the book, he mentions it's like this egalitarianism for the master race. So you become part of not nationalism, socialism, then you're treated well, which I see that reflected in kind of, just to use those words, you look at what is national and what is so not socialism so much in the equatable part, but the social mores. You know, in the U.S. we have these sort of social behaviors that are accepted as the status quo and that are promulgated as this is what the U.S. is about. So there's like a subtle form of national sociability, if you will. So that sort of my expanded awareness of this sort of Nazism as a part of this sort of human drama, the psychology that has that, and that's truly underneath all the labels, and beyond the labels is what we are working to eradicate. Yet, in the historical perspective, of course, this book is much more specific in going at what happened, why, you know, how the Nazis came to power, you know, what they studied about the U.S. laws, and so it gets very specific. So it's not to rule out the severity and the horrors of the Nazis, but I feel that some of this behavior is still in a different form, so, you know, prominent and strong in its way, that it's necessary to kind of look at it from different angles, different ways. Another personal thread is that my great-grandfather was a judge in the Brooklyn area, I think a court district judge, and so reading this book had me wondering what he may or may not have known, if anything. So in an odd way, I felt like I was getting closer, or at some level trying to communicate with my great-grandfather, so that's pretty cool. And then also on a personal note, my next book, Photo Albums of the Heart Mind, is 160 pages, going for that potent, short but potent, and this book is about 200 with all the footnotes and etc., but the actual text is 161 pages, so I thought that's pretty cool. And this is, you know, one of the best, I say in quotes, one of the best books I've read in a while, and one of the best ever, because I feel it is such a significant missing link to much of history, and to the, again, the connection of what I call this kind of lineage or thread of Nazism, which goes back before the Nazis, and because it shows, it sort of it debunks the whole idealized American exceptionalism view, and it points to another, yet again another personal note, that being a at one point a devotee as of Walt Whitman as a poet and a Long Islander, like many, became infatuated with Whitman before becoming a Long Islander. But anyway, it's something about having a local poet that speaks to where one is at, plus he happens to be world famous. So for many, many years I felt, you know, this devotee-ness, and still appreciate his poetry, but in the past few years I've sort of waned to the point of not that into Walt Whitman anymore. And the basic thing was what I call sort of populist imperialism, which gets to the heart, I think, of the schizoid behavior of the U.S. psychology, put it that way. So Whitman, as Whitman started to wane, partly mention of that in Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz's Native People's History of the U.S., and looking at some of the things that Whitman, said and did that were, okay, people say, well, in his time, you know, that was sort of the normal. Well, okay, even if that's so, then why now do we still sort of put him and people like him on a pedestal? So that's a whole other topic. But the point is, my interest in Whitman waned because he was, in some regard, promoting a new America at the expense of, you know, Native people and blacks and other minorities, even though his poetry said he was for that. But if you look at other texts and some of his journaling, you see the gist of what he was saying. I do think he promoted populist imperialism. And that is mentioned. I have several notes where that is mentioned in James Q. Whitman's book. That thread is the thread of white supremacy, domination, and legalese, and other stuff. But this book highlights the legalese, showing how the Nazis meticulously studied the laws and then, you know, framed them, so that there's layers to that. And also, when I say meticulously, there's also a section where he talks about I have to look up eventually what it's called. It's like legal realism, which is that it can be used both positively and negatively. So say a law from 100 years ago, if you're applying it now, perhaps you have to consider what is going on now to see the relevance to it. And that would, you know, flavor the law. But part of the way the Nazis took it was to sort of go beyond any kind of actual realistic view and apply it in a bigoted and racist way, to kind of bend the law, to not have the science. I think in the book there's references to what he says about without having actual science to show that, say, a black person or a Jew was inferior, yet they based their laws on that. So that's what I mean by this sort of delusional, not real, even though they, under the banner of a legal realism. And again, this is another book touching on legal matters in the way that Steve Newcomb's Pagans in the Promised Land breaks down the Christian doctrine of discovery and dehumanization, which is another part of the U.S. legal system. So it's fascinating to see these books show how the legal system still flavors what goes on today. And also fascinating, at some points in the book, when Whitman is talking about breaking down the legalese, to see how a lawyer thinks, and to see how you kind of the analyzing it and having to make a point. Where I would start to say, well, you know, that's obvious, but then realize, oh yeah, from a legal point, you need to break it down to show that point, to make a convincing thing. I think that's a very important thing in anything, with a personal matter or a discussion with someone, because so much of the news and so much of a lot of writing and journalism becomes just, you know, emotional making of points, which has its place, but at the disregard of the actual technical stuff. And the book is dedicated for the ghost of Louis B. Brodsky, Brodsky was a judge. He was a Manhattan magistrate who ordered the release of the five arrested rioters while delivering a fiery opinion denouncing Nazism in the name of American freedoms. So, again, in the context of the U.S., there's the book highlights too. There's this, I call it schizoid, but you know, perhaps you could call it a balance or an imbalance or a striving for balance. Is this the American angle, where we do have a lot of laws that are speaking towards freedoms, and that even nowadays you have judges ruling for things, which shows that that silver lining, bright side, positiveness of American law and what U.S. is on paper ideally meant to be. So that there's the showing of that, the positive side of the legal system, which not to deny that, but when I look at the overall flavor, I personally get sided with the bullshit has more power, but that's not to denounce that the other side, the positive side, you know, that the tide can't turn. So maybe we'll get through the introduction here. The introduction starts off with Roland Freisler, June 5th, 1934. A quote, "This jurisprudence would suit us perfectly with a single exception. Over there they have in mind, practically speaking, only coloreds and half-coloreds, which includes mestizos and mulattoes, but the Jews, who are also of interest to us, are not reckoned among the coloreds." And on June 5th, 1934, about a year and a half after Hitler became Chancellor of the Reich, the leading lawyers of Nazi Germany gathered at a meeting to plan what would become the Nuremberg Laws, the notorious anti-Jewish legislation of the Nazi race regime. The meeting was chaired by Franz Grüttner, the Reich Minister of Justice, and attended by officials who in the coming years would play central roles in the prosecution of Germany's Jews. Among those present was Bernard Leusner, one of the principal draftsmen of the Nuremberg Laws, and the terrifying Roland Freisler, later president of the Nazi People's Court, a man whose name had endured a byword for the 20th century judicial savagery. So this meeting and the notes there have become an important part of the notes that Whitman found and deciphered. So this is based on literal stuff. Here's a bit. "Indeed, in Mein Kampf, Hitler praised America as nothing less than, quote, the one state, end quote, that had made progress toward the creation of a healthy racist order of the kind the Nuremberg Laws were intended to establish." So there's a bunch of quite outlandish oxymorons in the book, healthy racist order, which is not the not Whitman's point of view, but just some point of view. "The Nazi persecution of the Jews and others culminating in the Holocaust counts for all of us as a supremely horrible crime of the 20th century, and the notion that Nazi policymakers might have been in some way inspired by American models may seem a bit too awful to contemplate. It may seem also implausible. We all think of America, whatever its undeniable faults, as the home of liberty and democracy." Well, all except if you're native. "As a country that put all of its might into the battle against fascism and Nazism that was finally won in 1945. Of course, we all know that America was home to its own racism in the era of the Nazi ascent to power, particularly the Jim Crow South." So that becomes a focal point. "In the 1930s, Nazi Germany and the American South had the look, in the words of two Southern historians, of a, quote, mirror image, end quote, being unapologetically racist regimes, unmatched in their pitilessness. In the 1930s, the Jews of Germany were hounded, beaten, and sometimes murdered by mobs and by the state alike. In the same years, the blacks of the American South were hounded, beaten, and sometimes murdered as well." So there's one of the specific connections. He also goes on to show a significant, what I found very significant, was that the extremism of what we come to know as Nazism, was not in some of the years preceding. It was not at that level. They even considered the in the planning and the trying to codify the laws, the codifying of the laws, they didn't, they even considered the America too blatant. So that was quite an eye-opener to hear that the Nazis, that gets explored later in the book, it was at a later point that they became the, you know, certainly extremist, totally violent, crazed, racist, whatever you call it. But all, you know, again, all building in this sense of this Aryan world domination and master race and white supremacy and Nordic supremacy, Anglo-Saxon, all these flavors of stuff, that horrible stuff that, you know, is still part of what we're dealing with today. So, and Whitman makes this point, it's really essential for Americans to come to terms with this. So that's part of the takeaway from the book. And some other bits in the introduction there. America was not just the South. It was a racist America writ much larger. Moreover, the ironic truth is that in the early 1930s, the Nazis drew on a range of American examples, both federal and state. There, America was not just the South. It was a racist America writ much larger. Moreover, the ironic truth is that when Nazis rejected the American example, it was sometimes because they thought that American practices were overly harsh. For Nazis of the early 30s, even radical ones, American race law sometimes looked too racist. And another interesting thing, he points out the difference between different lawyers, the radical lawyers and the less radical, you know, some that were trying to do things that were more in tune with the law, but that is in no way condoning the level of Nazism that they might have been promoting, but that there was a battle among the Nazis that eventually won out to the, you know, super extremist. Be it emphasized immediately that there was certainly never anything remotely like unmixed admiration for America among the Nazis, who aggressively rejected the liberal and democratic commitments of American governments. The Nazis were never interested in simply replacing the U.S. in Central Europe. Nevertheless, Nazi lawyers regarded America, not without reason, as the innovative world leader in the creation of racist law. And while they saw much to deplore, they also saw much to emulate. It is even possible, indeed likely, that the Nuremberg laws themselves reflect a direct American influence. And during the century or so since 1918, the glamour of America has proven particularly hard to resist. As interwar German racists observed, the U.S. had emerged after World War I as the premier power in the world. It is hardly surprising that the Nazis, like others, looked for what lessons the global powerhouse might have to teach, even as they also derided the liberal and democratic commitments of American society. Like others, the Nazis were impressed by the vigor of American industrial, my emphasis, industrial innovativeness and the vibrancy of Hollywood culture. Though their taste for American culture was heavily qualified by their disgust for the Negro music of jazz. Hitler in particular noted his admiration in Mein Kampf for the wealth of inventions generated by the U.S. None of this was peculiar to Nazi Germany. So that, again, pertinent to America today, and some of what my next book touches on is the whole influence of this Hollywood culture and this industrialness that is still a major part of what is considered as American way and better than. And so I think it's really essential to realize that much of that is flavored. That's, you know, it's debatable and a whole discussion how much, but you have to look at the fact that that is flavored. There's a Nazi flavor to that. Also enlightening to learn was, at one point, it's labeled the, quote, the fascist New Deal, because the New Deal, part of Roosevelt's New Deal in the early 30s, received distinctly favorable treatment in Nazi press until at least 1936 or 7. Lauded as a man who had seized dictatorial powers and embarked upon bold experiments in the spirit of the Führer. So there was a racist angle, segregationist angle in the South that was a key part of the New Deal. The New Deal depended on the political support of the segregationist South. So that's part of what the old Nazis were praising about that. So that was fascinating, because a lot of, I guess, I don't know exactly, from what I remember, a lot of populists and a lot of people point to, you know, recently in the news in the past bunch of years, seeing how things have taken a turn for the worse in some regards, people point to, whoa, where are the days of, you know, the New Deal and populism? So again, while that was a progress and a help for many, many people, again, it is flavored with that term, populist imperialism, and this Nazi flavor to the progress, America, and such like. And there was also some influence on Nazi eugenics and Nazi conquest in Eastern Europe. And back and forth, there was traffic between American and Nazi eugenists in the late 1930s. Another fascinating thing was they looked to the U.S. model of assembly line manufacturing in Hollywood popular culture. And then you have Ford. I think Ford was part of also the investment in the business, the oil and the car vehicles and stuff were part of the Nazi regime. So you have this whole whack culture, this whole assembly line, manufacturing, Hollywood, better than, this whole stuff. Sterilization of the mentally defective and the exclusion of immigrants who were supposedly genetically inferior. Their teachings filter into immigration law, not only in the U.S., but also in other Anglophone countries, Britain, Australia, Canada, and New Zealand, all began to screen immigrants for their hereditary fitness. So when you have recently Donald Trump talking about people coming into this country and immigration, looking at their talents, that is raises a freaking eyebrow. And also, of course, the Nazis took on what's called the Lebensraum, I don't know how you pronounce it, the living space, which was a flavor of the American Manifest Destiny and open space. And in the 90s, mid-90s, James Lowen's book, Lies My Teacher Told Me, mentions how Hitler was inspired by the concentration camps and the treatment. That he would apply that to as far as the Jews and gypsies and probably homosexuals and others. That whole treatment got put on, you know, in got morphed to the concentration camps. And so in that sense, you know, Whitman's book, as much as he shows it, he also comes a little bit from a, again, some of it from the legalese background of having to prove stuff, but a little bit of like, oh, this is amazing that this is happening in the U.S. Well, yes and no. So the land, again, here is mentioned the exemplary land empire for an expanding Germany that would engulf the territories to its east, and for generations of German imperialists and for Hitler himself, the exemplary land empire was the U.S. of America. In Nazi eyes, the U.S. ranked alongside the British to be respected as racial kindred and builders of a great empire. Both were Nordic polities that had undertaken epic programs of conquest. So that was my earlier point about dealing with the specifics and the you know, the historical specifics, but this underlying thing of, or this thread of the psychology and the behaviors of whatever you call it, empire, supremacy, Nazism, master race, Nordic, Aryan, whatever kind of bullshit you call it, it's under that same banner, that same flag-waving banner. And here's some more of Whitman. Indeed, as early as 1928, Hitler was speechifying, admiring about the way Americans had, quote, and gunned down the millions of Redskins to a few hundred thousand and now keep the modest remnant under observation in a cage, end quote. So yeah, some of the part of this book is a tough read. You got to have a strong stomach to deal with that, or strong mind, whatever you call it. But you know, gets to the point, and he continues after the quote, "And during the years of genocide in the early 1940s, Nazi leaders made repeated reference to the American conquest of the West when speaking of their own murderous conquest to their East." So he does know, Whitman does know about this. Historians have compiled many quotes from Hitler and others comparing Germany's conquest and its program of extermination with America's winning of the West. They are quotes that make for chilling reading, and there are historians who try to deny their significance. But the majority of scholars find the evidence too weighty to reject. Here's a quote, "The U.S. policy of westward expansion, as Norman Rich forcefully concludes, for example, in the course of which the white man ruthlessly thrust aside the inferior indigenous population, served as the model for Hitler's entire concept of Lebensraum." And eventually, though, the Nazis did go off on their own tangent. So he makes repeated points in the book that, while on the one hand, it's not accurate to say that the Nazi modeled, like, directly from America, you know, they didn't just say we've been they carbon copy, but they did find precedents and parallels and inspirations in the U.S. So it's some of it's semantics, I think. It's kind of a debatable. But again, in the legalese point, I think it's important to say it was not a direct model. You have to consider the, you know, the liberal and open-minded angle of America. So it was not a direct model, and yet is an undeniable influence. And Lowen's book, it also mentioned the book where he found that info about the concentration camp, I think, as author Toland, called Adolf Hitler. So some of the specifics the book gets into is the Immigration Act, immigration, miscegenation, which is intermarriage. So you have immigration legislation, miscegenation legislation, and then outright racist legislation. And towards the end of the introduction, "The Nazis were not simply demons who erupted out of some dark underworld to shatter what was good and just within the Western tradition, until they were put down by force of arms and the authentic, humane, and progressive values of Europe were restored. There were traditions of Western government within which they worked. There were continuities between Nazism and what came before and after." So also, not only in American race law, but also in some of the German background. And then again, you have to consider what heard John Trudell speak of this, that the Europeans, you know, coming over here, over to the U.S. with Columbus. But he talks about it as that what was practiced in Europe for centuries was then brought over to the U.S. A sort of, you know, what could be called a mental disease, and this whole pattern of subjugation and dehumanizing. So that gets into a whole nother longer backtrack. So again, to just point the finger at the U.S. and America is to miss the bigger picture, that what sometimes and is a part of the U.S.-America problem, tradition of this bigotry, racism, supremacy is not from here. It's not from this land. It goes back. So again, looking at what is a strong point to me of emphasizing the learning and celebration and tuning into this land and Turtle Island and the vibrations of it and the beauty of it and the ancestors, which is a whole nother track, a whole nother angle to this topic, but it's important to mention because it's in a ways, I don't know if you call it a balance point, but to me it speaks, and to many, speaks to the healing, the true healing of this land, air, and water. So I'll finish up with this part of the introduction. "None of this is to suggest that America was a Nazi country in the 1930s. Of course, it was not, appalling as the law of the early and mid-20th century sometimes was. Of course, the racist strains in American law coexisted and competed with some glorious, humane, and egalitarian strains. Of course, thoughtful Americans reviled Nazism, though there were certainly some who fell for Hitler. The most famous of the lawyers among them was none other than Roscoe Pound, dean of the Harvard Law School, icon of advanced American legal thought and a man who made little secret of his liking for Hitler in the 30s. Nazi lawyers, for their part, saw plenty of things to despise about America. The point is not that the American and Nazi race regimes were the same, but that the Nazis found examples and precedents in the American legal race order that they valued highly while simultaneously deploring and puzzling over the strength of the liberal countercurrent in a country with so much openly and unapologetically sanctioned racism. We can and should reject the sort of simple-minded anti-Americanism that blames the U.S. for all the evils of the world or reduces America to nothing but its history of racism. But there is no excuse for refusing to confront hard questions about our history and about the history of American influence abroad. The American impact on the rest of the world is not limited to what makes Americans proudest about their country. It has also included aspects of the American past that we might prefer to forget. We will not understand the history of Nazi nationalism, national socialist Germany, and more importantly, the place of America in the larger history of world racism unless we reckon with these facts. In the early 1930s, Nazi lawyers were engaged in creating a race law founded on anti-miscegenation and race-based immigration, naturalization, and second-class citizenship law. They went looking for foreign models and found them in the United States of America. So that's my personal intro and the book's intro. Even though it's only 145 more pages in the book, I get the sense, I'm not sure how many parts this show will be, but it could again be another long part if I give it the full justice, but I'm not sure. We'll see. You might try to sum it up in smaller levels. Just see how it goes. So thanks for listening, and be well, and don't forget to see the beauty in each being.
And we'll go out with a few minutes from Klaus Schulze's Mirage. He's one of the pioneers of electronic music, German. I think he just turned around 70. I heard that he may be having some health issues, so prayers sent out for his well-being. Super cool electronic music. Here's a taste of it.